Blog Talk Radio.
What's happening, fellow actors? It is I, William Powell, also known as the KDOC. That's King of DC Media, internationally known, nationally recognized, and locally appreciated. Welcome to another fantastic episode of Inside Acting. Tonight's episode is brought to you by The Class, Stage Presence for the Boardroom. To find out more about that wonderful class, go to www.performingartstudio.com. That's www.performingartstudio.com. It is also brought to you by DC Actors Examiner, found by Googling DC Actors Examiner. Tonight I'm welcoming director and actor and coach Robert G. Christie, who recently won the WMIFF Lifetime Achievement Award here in D.C. And I see he has joined us promptly. Hey, Robert, is that you?
Yeah, that's me.
All right. How you doing tonight?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad.
Okay. Fantastic. Fantastic. So, yeah, congratulations again on your Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It was actually very unexpected. I was actually very touched by it. Just didn't see it coming. And even though, you know, June DeGuisa, who presented it, gave a few clues here and there, but I just kind of assumed it might be somebody else and kind of zoned out. And then when they called me, I got up there to see this grand standing ovation. So I was very touched by it.
Yeah, I could tell. Yeah, I was there. I'll never forget it. That was quite a moment.
Yeah. And as you saw there, you know, since my mom had passed away on March 5th, so I dedicated the trophy to her.
Right.
So it was a very touching moment.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So tell all the listeners out there about some of the films you've directed.
The very first full feature I directed was one called No Longer My Twin. It was one of these spooky, supernatural, psychological thrillers that didn't really do well. I had my troubles, you know, directing it, producing it, and everything. Didn't have any money to work with. and I had trouble with, because when you don't have money to work with, it's hard to keep good, dedicated cast and crews. So it took me about 8 to 9 months on weekends to make the thing. And then at probably maybe the last month of it, something like that, my leading lady quit the production. And I had already had my troubles with so many months of trying to get it done, and I decided, well, my choices are start over or just go ahead and rewrite midstream. Yeah, and I knew that with Plan B, it could be bad thing, you know, that the audience may not get it, and it would give a lot of choppiness to the story. So I was exhausted. You know, looking back, I should have just dropped the project for a while, took a rest, and started over. But I decided to rewrite, and just as I feared, the audience wouldn't get it, and we went ahead and finished it, edited, put music to it, and it actually got accepted to one or two festivals, but it simply went nowhere. It just became my my first effort, my first failure. You know, that kind of
thing. Sounds like it was quite a learning experience.
Yeah, I certainly, you know, while you go through those things, you can really get down and lament. But at the same time, I took my mistakes with me and went to my second film called Shallow Deep. And right away, everybody noticed that I was technically shooting it much better. But the critics took that one and said, well, you know, the director was trying to do something pretty big with actors who just aren't measuring up. Yeah, so that one became, you know, something a little technically better. My choices of shots were better. My lighting was better. A lot of good. And the story premise was certainly understandable, but and it too managed to get into a couple of festivals. But I had to see it as, you know, an improvement.
Right.
And so it too didn't go anywhere, didn't get picked up. And then my third one was called The Sobbing Stone, which actually had a Christian message to it, but it was done in a clever way. I didn't write it. It was written by a British writer. It was done in a clever way. It was very Twilight Zone-y, you know, mysterious. You know, coupled in with a bit of sci-fi. And so I shot that very carefully, directed very carefully, edited everything very carefully. And I had learned a few lessons from people like Lionsgate, at that time Miramax, when they had been giving me tips on editing.
Okay.
And the tips they gave me was what did the trick for me. First of all, The Sobbing Stone went on to a European festival and got nominated Best Feature Drama. Yeah, in 2006. Well, it did pick up a distributor. So what the biggies, you know, like Lionsgate or Miramax was telling me at the time was that when you're editing, you're not really editing technically. You're editing the drama. So something along the lines of if you went to a live, you know, A-list Broadway play, and as we all know, that's done in one performance, one take for the evening.
Right.
And you took about, you know, a dozen cameras and put them in all of the various angles and then edit all that together. They said that's what a good edited movie should look like. It should look like it wasn't broken up, that it was all shot in one take with a dozen cameras. So I took my pointers. I even had to take some of my really technically beautiful shots and leave them out in favor of drama, you know, flowing evenly from one shot to the next. And so I remember very distinctly as I was editing, you know, that I would say, no, not this shot, because it's a beautiful shot, but it's not matching the next moment, you know, or the next line or anything like that.
You have to be merciless.
Yes. I had to be that way to myself, because the goal that we sometimes forget, the goal for us filmmakers is grabbing our audience. If our audience doesn't get into it psychologically and emotionally, we have failed. And that's when they might start noticing things like, gee, that one shot had great lighting, but the other shot didn't. Or, you know, that continuity was off. if the audience is doing that, then they're not paying attention to the drama. They're not grabbed. And I learned that, by the way, from Steven Spielberg, who used to say, in some of the tapes I've seen of him, he would say, an audience can easily forget lack of continuity if the drama is so gripping, you know, and so intense that they won't even notice, you know. And the only exception to that is if it's, you know, something technically blatantly noticeable.
Right, yeah, something blatant.
Yeah. But the rest of it, it's true. I've tested that over and over. It is true. A public in general, you know, the audience's job, and this is what I used to teach in classes all the time. The audience only wants one thing. Make me believe it. Make me get into it. They didn't come there to criticize. They didn't come there to tear you to pieces. They didn't come to watch lack of continuity or some crazy thing. They came only for one reason, and that's to be fulfilled emotionally and intellectually. And so I'm an audience. I want you to get me into it. I want to take my suspense of disbelief and use it to the utmost. You know, so when an audience comes and, you know, at least a general audience, because we know some people, you know, go to these things and they're purposely tearing apart. But I mean a general audience, they're investing, you know, a couple of hours of their time and or money if they pay at the door to come watch us. And if we don't produce it in such a way as to make the audience walk away feeling and or thinking something, we have failed. You know, and...
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, you know, my old trainers, I attended Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, and the theater, Morehouse itself did not have a theater department at the time. So we had to go to Spelman College, which is the girls' college, where the theater building was, and where we could, you know, we could interchangeably major in each other's subjects on each other's campuses. And the trainers that I had at the time were very, you know, strict and very, you know, they could scream at you and take your head off in a jiff.
Wow.
And they used to say, if you don't fulfill your audience, you owe them an apology. You owe them, or you should give them back their money if you can. You know,
That's right.
We don't have that kind of discipline anymore, you know. I think it's great that we're having this, you know, influx of independent films in an age where you can do them, you know, digitally, much easier, much quicker. What we have is a lot of people who are really not very disciplined, and they don't understand that their job is to fulfill the audience, not to fulfill themselves.
That's correct. I agree with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's old school for me, you know. And some filmmakers today will do that. A few of the films that I saw at the festival, you know, at WMIFF, were really quite good. They seem to have that sense, you know, that thing that says, I don't want to just fulfill me. I need to fulfill the public, the audience that comes, that even bothers to sit there and watch what I'm doing, you know, what I've produced, directed. So, you know, that's how I try to do it, you know, considering the problems of not having money, then you don't have, you know, you may get your good actors, but there's so many conflicts because they have an 8-to-5 job. There's so much to put up with. So what could literally sometimes take me 4 or 5 weekends to shoot a full feature. And I mean, given there aren't any really special effects and complex shots, it's feasible to do a full feature in 4 or 5 weekends. But you can't because, you know, you have this leading lady works on Saturday, that leading man works on Sunday. My strong supporting character works every other Sunday. You know, it's like that, and it's pretty tough.
Hmm.
So,
what separates the well-prepared actor on the set from the less prepared actor on the set?
Oh, very good question. I have my troubles with that one a lot. In my last movie, the one that got nominated at the WMIFF Festival, was called As Thick as the Waters. And the one great experience that I had with those guys is that they came thoroughly prepared. Well, a lot of actors mistake that with being nothing more than you memorize your lines. You just barely got through your lines. And many of them don't even do that. But the truth is that that's only part of the preparation. In fact, it's a small part. Because if I, for example, was playing the role of William Powell, see,
mm-hmm.
and I end up studying him a little bit, and I end up realizing that he has a certain pattern of talk. And now I want to know why. So when he's talking in a certain way, or he's walking in a certain way, or he gestures, or when you talk to him and you look at him eye to eye, there's a certain way he looks at you. And there's a certain way he smiles at you when he does. and things like that. Well, the characters in a script are supposed to be studied the same way. When I study, if I were to study one in Powell, given all of those physicals that I saw, my next question as an actor wanting to portray you is, why? Why does he do that? Why does he talk this way? Why does he gesture this way? What makes him hesitant when you talk about certain things? What makes him very comfortable when he talks about others? What makes him smile that way when he said that? And I noticed that when he smiled that way, that smile wasn't needed, but he gave it to me anyway. I wonder why. See, if I get to understand what makes you tick, I will then be able to portray you in a film or a play. Well, let's jump over to the script. We have one major difference, of course, is that in the script, it's a printed character. I don't get to sit in front of a William Powell and interview and figure out how he behaves. So all I have is words. So when a good actor studies a script, the first thing he's trying to figure out is, you know, after the first read, to get familiarized with the story. Then the next thing they're trying to do is, wow, why did he say that? And why did he say that in that way? Or why didn't he say something? And movie scripts have just a few descriptions here and there, and so you pay close attention to those. You know, a simple description like, in walks John Smith with a slight limp on his left leg, but doesn't seem to be physically wounded. A simple, and then it leaves it at that, because scripts don't have big descriptions. So So it leaves it at that. Gave you two sentences to describe the man, and the rest of it is me trying to familiarize myself with him by the way he talks, by the way he expresses himself. So that's where now I try to figure out, okay, he walks a certain way, he has a limp, but he's not physically injured. Let me figure out his heart. I need to know why he has that limp.
Why does he limp?
Well, because he may have a wounded heart, for example.
Okay.
He may be someone who's very defeated by life and doesn't even realize that he has a very slight limp. And I meant it to be slight, by the way. Because it's only slight. When you see him walk, you kind of go, there is and there isn't. And I know people like this in real life. See, that if you really trying to figure them out, you first have to figure them out. And in films, is mostly through the dialogue, the language. You know, obviously we got to follow the plot and see what that entails, and then of course figure out what my character wants. From the moment that he enters the picture, you know, in the script, to the moment he leaves, what is it that my character wants? What does he want in life? What does he want now? That will help him to get there. Things like that. Wants are so important, and they're so often neglected by actors. So these days, when I audition an actor, I'm actually trying to figure out what makes the actor tick. You know, part of it now is an interview.
Okay.
What I did do the years of training, you know, because I actually stopped. Last April was my last class.
Oh, okay.
And I did about 18 years of it. And one advantage I had was I got to know actors. I got to know how they work, how they function, what their insecurities are. You know, that I really can't give each actor the exact same note.
Oh.
Yeah. See, so if I'm directing, say, William Powell, and I'm directing, Altora Black, I know it's my job is to get to know you as soon as possible, because as soon as I go through that day of shooting, especially that first day of shooting, I'll know any number of things. One is I may not have to give you a lot of direction. You're just one of those that catches on.
Right.
Or as I did in As Thick as the Waters, where my leading lady had the raw talent, but she hadn't done much acting since her college days, you know. And so what I was focused on was, okay, I got to get the rust out. She's probably rusty. But she had enough raw talent and enough courage to do everything that's needed for the character for me to take a chance on her. And then when we got to the shooting, I need to talk to her in a certain way. And the leading lady, by the way, her name was Jeanette Lowe, who got nominated at WMFF. I had to talk to her in a certain way versus Kira Tiffany, who played her mother, who would come in so prepped, and she knew the entire script inside and out. She knew exactly, I mean, I could ask her any question in the entire script and she could answer it.
That's good.
And so did Jeanette, and so did Altora Prince Black. And later Laura Michelli joined us, and I could ask him anything, anywhere in that script, and they go, oh yeah, that's right. Do you remember that time when, you remember in scene 40 where we, you see, they knew, you need that kind of actor. You know, Anthony Hopkins Anthony Hopkins says that he reads the script about 15 times and so that he could study the all of the undercurrents of the script. Everything, you know, because, you know, any scene can be kind of surfacey. You know, two people walk in, they say hello to each other. Hey, John, how you doing? Oh, I'm doing great. Oh, well, how's the wife? Oh, she's doing fine. See, that's all on the surface.
Got to get the subtext.
Right. Right. See, but if we study our characters very carefully, we realize that, you know, they walk into the room and these two have an undercurrent, a conflict that's not showing on the surface.
Exactly. They have some history there. You got to read the script to get the history.
Right.
So, Robert, we've got about 4 minutes. So mm-hmm. we had about two or three questions I want to get in before we run out of time here.
Okay.
One is about, I know you mentioned that you were down at Morehouse. I wanted to ask you about, did you get a chance to work for Sam Jackson? The second question is, name some of the better, some of the best actors out there that are, you know, the more famous actors. And lastly, just put out your some information on how we can buy some of your films.
Okay. I was at Morehouse from 1966 to 70, and I did work with Samuel L. Jackson in one production. It was a musical comedy. Holy cow, the title of it escapes me now. Maybe it'll come to me in a minute. When I was at Morehouse, I was already, you know, very trained, very ripe actor. And in my senior year, Samuel L. Jackson decided to join this production, suggested by his English teacher, because he was, you know, trying to find himself a bit, and so he joined that. And what a lot of people don't know is that he was actually pretty terrible.
Okay.
Yeah. But long story short, I graduated from Morehouse that year, and the next year I came to visit during homecoming, and I saw him in a rehearsal, and it was a complete turnaround. He had become an incredible actor almost, you know, just a year's time. And I walked up to him and I said, "Sam, what's up with this? You know, just a year ago you were just clowning with this." And he said, "Oh, I've made up my mind, Robert. This is the one. This is the one for me. This is my career. I'm going to break in big time." And the rest we know.
Wow. Okay, we got about 2 minutes. So what's some
okay.
of the better actors that are out there now?
You know, one of the ones you don't see too much, Colin Farrell. You know, I think he's a tremendous actor. But it's ironic, too. I watch a lot of foreign films, and I think some of the best actors in the world, nobody knows their names, not on this side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I could easily rattle off a couple of names, but, you know, we wouldn't know who they are. But I think some of the world's best actors are on the other side of the world.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how we can buy some of your films.
Well, the only one that's really officially out on the market right now is The Sobbing Stone. That could be found, if you do a Google search, you'll find that. And the various websites you could purchase it at. And the first two never got distribution, so we haven't been self-selling. Plus, with the new technology, we decided to remake them. And the latest one, As Thick as the Waters, is just about to be, in fact, we're about to send a copy to Lionsgate. They want to see it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Well, Robert, I really want to thank you for coming on the show. I've just been in awe of the acting wisdom you've imparted to us tonight. It's really fantastic.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Well, definitely have you on again.
Okay, sure. Anytime.
Okay, thanks. Have a great night.
Right, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. And I want to tell all of my listeners out there to do something for your career every day and break a leg. Good night.